We were halfway down the coast of Australia on the way to Sydney. As everyone knows, the Barrier Reef is offshore and it runs from north to south down the off the coast of Australia. When a ship, an American ship, came steaming from the east, way out, and the pilot kept watching them, watching the ship, and eventually it came right through and almost in front of us. So the pilot got his loud hail and called across. Don't you know about the reef? And the American ship called back, "What reef?" As I mentioned earlier, I never held much score for the navigational abilities of the American seamen. How they'd got through the reef without going aground and causing damage to the ship, heaven only knows. The pilot said he was going to report him. So we steamed on and eventually we came to Sydney. It was really nice arriving in Sydney. We went through and underneath the Sydney Bridge. I've got a photograph somewhere of the Natasina going under the bridge at Sydney. Photographers used to photograph ships going under the bridge and then come round, find out where the ship docked and bring photographs round and sell them to the crew. So I bought one. It was a very nice harbour, beautiful place. Anyway, we reached the oil installation and stopped there, tied up there, and I ordered stores and another nice ship's chandler there, a fat chap, I can't remember his name, and he invited me home to his home for an evening meal and meet his wife and family. He had two or three little children. And later that week, a couple of days after, I had an afternoon off, and he took me with the family out to some park where sat at tables in the open air, and kangaroos and what have you were all coming around the tables for food. It was beautiful. He told me that was that's how they lived out there. On a Friday night, there was a mass exodus. Everybody piled everything up in their cars and went into the outback, as they called it, to have a weekend under canvas and camp and that. And then they all flocked back on Sunday, ready to start work on Monday. When we got to Sydney there, quite a few of the crew were deserted. And the immigration, we had to get the immigration people on board because I was in charge of the crew lists for the, like as I've mentioned, that men used to spend, buy cigarettes and what have you from the bonded store. Well, I had to keep a record of this and then ended up on their wages sheets, deduct what they'd had without paying for it in cash sort of thing, to keep a record of what they owed in the ship and how much money they were entitled to. But some of these fellows had drawn their money to go ashore on a couple of days, a day's leave or so, and they never come back. So when the immigration man came aboard, I told them, told about this. He said, "Oh," he said, "this is going on every ship that's coming in." He says, "Don't worry." He said, "You'll be lucky to get a crew to leave." And I asked him what happened to them. He said, "Oh, usually we find them, we get them." And I said, "What happens to them?" He said, "Oh, well, we put them into a compound." He said, old army camp in, living in huts. He said, "And then we find them jobs." I said, "Is that all there's to it?" He said, "Oh yeah." He said, "It's It's cheap immigration for the Australian government. You must remember that at this time, Australia was calling for immigrants and people were leaving England and going out there. And the Australian government, at that time, I think you could emigrate from the UK to Australia for £10. But the Australian government made up the rest of the money for your passage out. So this way, it was cheaper for the Australian government. They weren't paying anything. So they closed their eyes to it. So the only thing was that the only people going wanted to leave Australia were the dead legs of crews, you know, didn't like it anywhere sort of thing. Anyway, we made up a crew and we set off again to Miri, up the coast, up to Miri. And we loaded there again. And I started having terrible trouble with my nose. I couldn't breathe. Oh, it was shocking. I'd been troubled for a while, slightly. Whether it was the climate or not, I don't know, but it got worse and worse. So I started taking sleeping pills, and I overslept a couple of times, and Jimmy Gill asked what was the matter, and he spoke to the captain and said, oh, you'd better see a doctor when you get in Port Arthur, you know. So when we got back to Sydney, they sent me to see a specialist, and said, yes, so you'll have to go to the hospital and have an operation. I wasn't too keen, but the captain says, go on, he says, Shell pays for all this, he said. They'll see you're all right. Don't worry, he said, I'll get the third officer to look after the victualling books for you until you get back. You have this trip off, and we'll join the ship when we come back to Sydney. So I done that. The ship went off, and I went into this private hospital. And what a hospital. To me, it was like a small detached house that you see around any town. It was only in a road, and it was just, as I say, a detached house. I think there was only two bedrooms in it, like, or wards, as you call them. And they put me in this ward with some old chap. His name was Smith, and he must have been about 70-odd then. Anyway, I wasn't too keen on this operation, and it made me feel that I'd never have another. I'd never go into hospital for another operation. Anyway, they took me into this room, which they call the theatre, and they didn't put me to sleep. They gave me injections and put some stuff round my nose and my eyes, frozen, and then they started packing cotton wool up my nose. It seemed like yards of it. I could feel my head stretching as if it was about 4 or 5 times the normal size. Ooh, it was an awful feeling. And then they put a towel across my eyes, and he started like a little saw up inside my nose. And the noise, it was just like two men with a big saw cutting a tree down. That's what it sounded like inside my nose. And it went on and on. And then they finished with that, and they put some like tweezers up, and he bent them. I could feel the bone cracking. And they pulled it out, and they took the bone out of my nose. I'd done a bit of boxing, and I'd had it. It had been bad for years. They took this bit of bone out. And as they were working on me, the towel kept coming off in the finish. I said, and they kept stopping to put the towel back. I said, oh, for God's sake, leave the towel off. And then he put this little bit of chrome up inside and fitted it in some way. And then they started pulling all this cotton wool out, yards and yards of it, all soaked with blood. Oh, it was a horrible feeling. Oh, God, I'll never forget it. And then they put me in another room. And there was no mirrors or anything in the room. Now, the ship's radio officer, he'd been having something done to his foot. And he'd had a trip off. He was off, but he was all right. He was only having outdoor treatment. So the next day, he called in to see me. And I was lying there. I hadn't had a shave and I'd fallen asleep. And the door opened and I saw him standing there. And he says, "Jesus." I said, "What's the matter?" And he walked over. He says, "Have you seen yourself?" I looked around, there's no mirrors. I said, "There's no mirrors." So he had one of those little chromium pocket mirrors. He was always combing his hair. And he had a chromium pocket mirror. And he held it in front of my face. Both my eyes were closed up. It looked as if I'd been in the ring, the boxing ring, with Joe Louis for about 10 rounds. My face was all swollen out. And I'd had a day's growth. And they hadn't washed me face. All the blood was still on me face and on me neck. So while he was there, this nurse came in and he said, "Aren't you going to wash him? Wash that blood away?" So she said, "I've come to do that." She was quite a nice girl, a big hefty girl. So she washed the blood off and she shaved me with a safety razor. So I was in there, but put me back in this room with this old chap. He kept asking me about what was life like in the UK and where'd I come from. He'd never heard of the Isle of Man. Anyway, I got quite friendly with this nurse. She was kept joking every time she come in. So I was there about a week, I think it'd be. I'd be in the hospital. And then they said I could go, so I asked this nurse for a date, if I could take her to the pictures. Before I could get an answer from her, the sister came in. So as I was going out, I said, "I'll pop round tomorrow and see you," whispered to her. So I went off and Shell had arranged for me to stay at an hotel. So I went and got into the hotel, and the next day I went round to this hospital. So I thought, you know, what excuse can I have to go back and ask for her? Now, this old Mr. Smith, his name was, he was had a passion for sweets, not jelly babies, but jelly beans. Whether they're an Australian sweet, I don't know. Jelly beans are very cheap things, but I went in this shop and I bought a big bag, a pound of jelly beans. I thought I'll take them and say I'm going to see him. So I went round to this hospital and I got into the front door and the sister was there. So she says, "Oh, Mr. Adams, what have you come back for?" So I said, "Oh, I've come to see Mr. Smith." She said, oh. So she said, "You've come at a very bad time." So just then a woman came downstairs and she was crying. So this matron went over and spoke to her. So this woman came and she says, the matron said, "What's the bag?" I said, "I've got some jelly beans for Mr. Smith." So this woman, after the matron spoke to her, she came over and she put her hands on my shoulder and she says, "Oh, to think that you, a stranger, coming to see my father." I said, "How is he?" She said, "He's just died about half an hour ago." Ooh, if the ground could have opened up and swallowed me, I'd have been thankful. She was saying, "It was wonderful to think that you, a stranger, would come back to see him." Oh, God, I was there. I couldn't get out quick enough. So as I was going out the door, this girl, Muriel her name was, Muriel Gilmore Smith, she was just nipping out, so I waited outside and she come out, so I asked her if she got the pictures. So she did. She said she got the pictures and it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was a Thursday night. So I asked her if I could see her any other night. So she said, well, I'm going home to visit my parents. I've got the weekend off. I'm going to visit my parents. She said, so she told me they lived up in the hills, a place called Coolah, C-O-O-L-A-H, in the Blue Mountains. They had a sheep farm. So she said, would you like to come with me? So I said, what do your father and mother say? So there was a phone box not far from where we were standing. So she went and rang them up and she said, that's all right. So on the Friday night, I met her and we caught a train up to this place called Coolah. And her father was there waiting with like a station wagon car. And he had a massive place, this sheep farm. Must have had thousands of sheep. I took a few photographs while I was there. And the air up in the mountains was making my nose feel smashing. Immediately after the operation, it was just as if they'd cut a big hole in my face. And the doctor said, now that, you'll have no trouble with your breathing anymore. That's how it'll be from now on. Now up in these Blue Mountains, the mountain there, it was marvellous. I felt absolutely terrific. Anyway, had the weekend there and went down a few days, took her out to the cinema again, and a few days later the ship came in. I took her down on board to meet all the officers and that, and she promised she'd write to me. Anyway, to cut the long story short, after we left Sydney, I never seen her again. But a strange thing too, the bosun had broken his arm on that trip, the trip I had off, and they'd put a temporary splint on it. The chief officer, Jimmy Gill, and the captain between them. So the bosun didn't want to leave the ship because once you paid off in a foreign land, your pay stopped at that minute. Your pay absolutely stopped at that minute. And didn't start again. If you could come home, what they call distressed British seamen, you got a shilling a month or something like, ridiculous thing like that. So anyway, we sent the bosun by taxi to the hospital. And I was getting things really organised, the stores and what have you, loaded up. And the captain said, well, if he's coming back, someone will have to go to the hospital to find out if the splint has to be taken off before we get home, how to do it. So Jimmy Gill said, well, I'll go with you and me, Arthur, eh? So I said, very good, Jim. So this was early at breakfast, at the breakfast table. Now the captain was going ashore to meet some officials at the Shell Company at the Hotel Sheraton or something it was called, a big hotel in the middle of Sydney. And Jimmy Gill was supposed to meet him there at 12:30 to attend the luncheon with him. So Jimmy Gill said, I'll go with you and we'll get a taxi and you can drop me off at the hotel and I'll and then carry on to the station and get the train out to where the ship is. Because as I've already mentioned, where the oil tanks, storage tanks are, they're all usually quite about a few miles from the city. So fair enough, we went ashore and walking along the dock road and Jimmy Gill said, oh, I could do with a drink, Arthur. I could just do with a drink. He loved his drink, Jimmy Gill. So I said, no, we'd better go and get to the hospital, Jim. So he said, no, I must have a drink. So we went into this little bar there, and Jimmy Gill said, a Scotch whiskey, please. So the bloke said, I'm sorry, we've got no Scotch. He said, well, we've only got Australian whiskey. Jimmy Gill said, oh, that won't be strong enough for me. this bloke said, oh, it's pretty strong. So there's nothing else anyway. So he had a couple of whiskies and I had a lager. Walked on a bit more and it was boiling hot this day. He stopped at another pub. Let's go and have another couple of whiskies. And then he had some beer. I think it was four pubs we stopped at. Got to the hospital. Saw the sister at the hospital. And she told us about the bosun who'd been to the outpatients department. They'd put plaster of Paris on and picked his arm up. And Jimmy Gill said, well, we want to know how to take a plaster off. So she took us into a little room there and showed us. She said, you'll have sores and that on board, won't you, sores? Said, yes. So we set off, went outside to get a taxi. I could see Jimmy Gill was looking a bit funny, so he says, quick, get us a taxi. So we got the taxi. And I was sitting alongside him, and every now and again he kept going, So I was waiting to be sick, so I said, come on, Jimmy, shake yourself. You've got to meet the captain. You've got to meet him for this dinner. Anyway, we got to this hotel. I told the driver where to stop at the hotel, so I said, Jimmy, here we are, you get out and go in. And he said, oh, gosh, no, I can't. I couldn't face lunch. Come on, get me back to the ship. So I told this driver to take us to the station, so we got to the station, and it wasn't an underground train, but a small train like it used to be at Liverpool, the dock railway. We got in this train, as I say, it was midday. Train was packed. We had to stand. And we got going, and he kept boop, boop. Eventually, we were about halfway back to the station where the ship was, and he was sick all over. There was a man and a woman sitting on a seat. He was sick all over, this man. The people didn't half start calling them limey. Oh, God. Over the first couple of seconds after the train stopped, I grabbed his arm and pulled him out. Come on, get out. He was sick all over the platform. I looked outside the station and there was some taxis, so took him into a corner, got him into the toilets in the waiting room, and he was sick. Got this taxi and right back to the ship. We got back at lunchtime. By that time, he could hardly stand. I took him to his cabin. He was sick all over his suit, all his trousers and his jacket. And he only had the one suit. It wasn't a uniform suit. It was a civilian suit. So got him to his cabin, took his suit off, just left it there, said he left his wash that. Later, Jimmy didn't know what was going on. Lay him on the settee, put a blanket over him and left him. Now, he was due on watch at 4, the chief officer done the 4 to 8 watch. The third officer done the 8 to 12 watch. And the second officer done the 12 to 4 watch. That's the usual thing. Routine on ships. So Jimmy was due on watch at 4. Anyway, I went and had a bit of a meal and started doing me books. But 3:45, I could hear Jimmy Gill whistling. He was up, he was washed. In his uniform, well, he only ever used to wear trousers and a shirt on board ship, Jimmy. And he comes, bounces his head round the door of my cabin and saying, you're all right? I said, yeah, how are you? He said, fine, fine. And he had this dirty suit. And he took it out on deck and the tank lids were open. They were discharging the cargo. He tied his suit onto a heaving line and put a weight on it and threw it down into the petrol, into the cargo. I says, what are you doing? I went down and texted him. I said, what the devil are you doing? He says, oh, this will soon see me suit okay. So he was going round on deck, supervising the discharging the cargo. Short while after, He takes it out, then he goes and puts it in water and washes it. Hung it out on a bit of a line to dry. When he finished washing it at 8 o'clock, he ironed it and he went ashore in it. That was Jimmy Gill. Oh, he was a character. He was a character. The captain wasn't too pleased with Jimmy when he came back, but still. Anyway, we were finished discharging, got all our stores aboard, and we set off for Aberdeen. I watched Australia disappear. I often wondered in the years that followed how I'd have got on if I'd have jumped ship myself there, because I really liked the country. I thought it was a lovely place, especially Sydney. And we set off up for Aberdeen. It was a good long journey again. And we'd be at sea a few days. And I was sitting in my cabin one morning, I think it was, morning. And I was doing me books, me victualling books. You had to keep a record daily of what amount of storage you've used each day, so that you can keep a record on you. When you get in port, you know exactly what to order again. And I was making menus out, and I had all my books all open. And above my desk, there was a porthole which was open. And I was busily engrossed in doing the books, and all of a sudden a voice said, "I've cut me finger, steward." So I looked up, and it was one of the firemen greasers, only a young bloke, it was early 20s. So I said, "All right, okay, come in the room now. I'll put a plaster on." Now, the medicine chest was down on the deck below, so for minor things, I used to keep plasters and aspirins, a bottle of aspirins and things like that in the room in case somebody cut the finger. They want a bit of a sticking plaster to put on a cut or anything like that. You just keep them on a shelf by the side of my desk. So I said, "Well, come round, I'll put a plaster on." He says, "I'm too dirty. I'm just come up from the engine room." His face was covered in dirt and that. So I said, "I'm not fussy." I said, "Come round and I'll put a plaster on. You're all right." He says, "No, I'm too dirty, steward." So I lost my temper a bit. I said, "Oh, for God's sake." I said, "All right." I said, "Well," and I got starting to get up to reach for the plasters. I said, "Put your hand through the porthole. I'll put a plaster on here." But before I could get up properly, I could see the blood was pouring onto me whittling books. They were covered in blood. When I looked, it was his right hand and his index finger. His index finger was hanging on by just a little tiny bit of skin. It was hanging down. It knocked me sick. I hate the sight of blood. I'm not very too good, but of course, when the need arises, you just have to do it. So I shouted to him, "Right down to the hospital, down to the hospital." So I run up myself up to the bridge, up the flight of the stairs from my deck up to the bridge, and got hold of the captain. I said, "There's a chap down there, captain. He's got his fingers hanging off, just hanging, barely hanging on. I'll have to do something. You'll have to get in touch with the ship with the doctor." That was the usual procedure. If there was any problems, you have to radio, asking advice from any ship in the vicinity that carries a doctor. This was normal procedure. So he said, "I'll get onto the radio operator." He said, "Get Jimmy Gill to give you the hand." So on my way down the stairs, Jimmy's cabin was just behind mine. I called him quick. I said, "We've got an emergency." So I got down there, and this lad, he was covered in muck. He'd been underneath in the bilges. That's under the floor of the engine room, cleaning. And told Jim McGill, you know, quick. I opened the hospital, told this lad to go in and sit down. I went to the medicine chest to get cotton wool and lint and what I could think of I'd need. And this lad was just calm as if he'd just nicked his finger. No panic or anything at all. He was just quite normal. And he said to me, he said, "I'm sorry to trouble you, Stuart." I said, "Bloody hell, don't say that." So I got me bowl and surgical spirits and cotton wool. I said, "Would you like a drink?" He says, "Aye, all right." So Jimmy looked a bit sick, so I went and got a bottle of rum and three glasses. So I poured three glasses of rum, good big tots, and give the lad one, Jimmy Gill, and I started. I was waiting for word from the hospital. I was trying to mop the blood up. I put a tourniquet on his arm to stop the bleeding. It was like pumping blood out, and Jimmy Gill was helping me. We got the tourniquet on. Well, then we started getting the message from the radio. Now, the procedure is the radio operator is in contact with the radio operator on the ship with the doctor, and the doctor tells, is standing by the radio operator passing messages on. On our ship, it's like two floors up. The captain had got a seaman standing outside the radio room at the top of the stairs. And then on the next deck, he had another bloke seaman standing. So when the word came from, they got in touch with the ship and the doctor, but they were too far away from us to join up, sort of thing. So the captain asked me exactly what it was, so I had to shout up, you know, I was taking stock of it. The fingers hanging on with just a bit of skin, it's through the bone, and this skin's just hanging on by about an eighth or a quarter of an inch. So he passed out, and the word come back, amputate. God. Jimmy Gill looked at me. Oh, yeah, okay. So I rushed up to the chest, which was in the corner by the hospital, got scalpels. So I had to ask, how? So the word went back, I had to cut it in a triangular shape so that this little bit of flesh would flip back over the opening. So I had to cut this finger off, ugh, I'm thinking of it, and cut it like a V. And then the word was to put three stitches, one at the back and one each side of this skin. All this is being shouted down, come from the radio operator. Cut in a V, cut in a V, cut in a V, you know. What next? What next? What next? Stitch, three stitches, one at the back, one each side. Stitch at the back, one each side. All down the line. I said, this lad called, do you want another drink? He said, no, I'm all right, Stuart. So I poured myself one, and Jimmy Gill had another. He said, I'll have one. So I made this lad have another rum. Then I had to get these glass phials with the needle and the thread in and break it and put the three stitches in. Oh, I gave him morphine tablets first to start this. And he was just that calm and collected. Then the next instruction was to look in the medicine chest. I'd never forgotten the name of it. I'd never heard of it before. White precipitate ointment. So I rushed to the medicine chest, and there it was, a big tub thing with this white precipitate ointment. I washed his hand with spirits and covered all this, when I'd amputated the finger, with this ointment all thick, and then bandage it up. And that's what I had to do. And then the instructions were to make for the nearest port. So we done that. And Jimmy Gill and I had another run. And as I say, this lad was absolutely filthy. So we undressed him and filled the bath, put him in the bath, and we give him a bath. And we got one of the blokes to go down aft to his cabin and get some clean, dry clothes. So they brought some clean, dry clothes up, and we helped him get dressed. And he was still quite normal. He was more normal than what Jimmy Gill and I were. And I said, do you want to lie on the bed? You know, we put you, do you want to get to bed? Like in the hospital, the bed there. So he says, no, he says, it's hot in here. He said, can I, I'll sit on deck. So we got a mattress from the store and a couple of crates and that, and made a little bed outside on the deck for him. And we went off, and Jimmy Gill and I left him. His mates kept coming and seeing him and talking to him and that. But about 4:30 in the afternoon, it set in, the reaction, and he was in terrible pain, I suppose, and twisting about. We had to strap him down in his bunk, in the bunk, put him in the bed in the hospital, and the ship went into Bombay. We went into Bombay and put him ashore there. The hospital came. Well, we lay at anchor, and a little boat came out and took him ashore. Well, it was quite an experience. It was never a dull moment. Never a dull moment being chief steward. Anyway, we went on to Aberdeen and we loaded there for Avonmouth in the west country, west of England. Oh, I had these two big chests. I was worried about getting them home. But the ship's carpenter was quite a nice bloke, and he said, I'll make a couple of crates for you. So he made me two good, really strong, substantial crates to pack them in. How I got them home, God only knows. Because I had a big suitcase, and I had another packing case that I used to always bring a bit of foodstuffs for Winnie, my sister Winnie, in. And then I had a sea bag. A canvas sea bag. I'd made it myself a few years before on one of the ships. It was almost shoulder height. I used to sling it over my shoulder. So I had these two big crates, my kit bag, sea bag, a suitcase, and a box of stores. I had to put them on the train at Avonmouth, and I go, I'd get up and change it, so I forget what I changed. Must have been Bristol, I suppose. And then up to Liverpool. I had to change again at Crewe. And then on to Liverpool. Then I had to get a taxi with all this on down from the station at Liverpool, down to the boat. Then I had to hire a porter to get them aboard for me. When I got back to Douglas, there was a chap, I've been trying to think of his name, I'm not too sure of his name. I'm feeling it was Lee. Rather tall, skinny bloke. He was a porter. He used to have hand porters there waiting for the boat to come in with wooden hand carts, two big wheels. And whenever I come on leave, he knew my father and Eric, I think, my brother. If he ever saw me, he used to put his hand up and wave, you know. Okay, I'll see you, okay. So, when he come aboard, he says, bloody hell, Arthur, where have you? What's all this, you know? And I said to him, you know, you won't be able to manage this. So, because you had to push it all the way up Prospect Hill and up Bucks Road. It's all uphill up to where my sister lived in Domain Road. And he says, oh, don't worry about it, I'll get it all home for you. And it was funny, whenever I went home on leave, I never give Winnie much inclination, or I just see this chap, this boarder, and he'd load me stuff up, and then I'd call in the Clarendon Hotel and have a drink, and he'd turn up at Winnie's house with all the luggage and say, he's back. Occasionally, I did send a telegram from Liverpool, and I used to just send it to Mrs. Cooley, Domain Road, Douglas. Kippers for tea. No signature. Kippers for tea. And she would know then I was coming home. But those camphorwood chests, I've still got them here. The carving on them is absolutely marvellous. So, still got the two of them. The previous trip on the Natasina, when we'd been at West Africa, I'd brought home a little coffee table, quite a thick top. It's a carved elephant with a small table top. About, oh, it must be 2 inches thick, the top. African mahogany. And I also brought a carved elephant, a piano stool, tall enough to sit and play a piano on, quite a big one. And I also brought another coffee table. It had 6 sides on it. And a couple of carved heads in African mahogany. I probably used to bring quite a lot of stuff home. But when I left that ship, it was the 25th of August, 1947. And I'd first joined the ship on January the 1st, 1946. So I'd been about 18 months on board that ship. It was the longest time I spent on one ship, and I really liked it. I had quite a bit of leave due to me by then. But at that time, I never seemed to get a full leave. There were that many men leaving the sea who had been in for the wartime, just for the wartime. As I think I said before, those that had been called back, and they wanted to get back home as soon as possible, the older ones and the younger ones who joined just for the wartime, they wanted to get a shore job, they were leaving. So the companies were finding it difficult to get crews to man the ships. So I'd be home for a few weeks, and then I'd get a call or a telegram from the company, could you please oblige, you know, we're short-staffed. So I would go back to oblige them. Now, when you left the ship, you went on leave. Say you had 6 weeks leave. You were paid when you went on leave. So if you were called back after 4 weeks, you had 2 weeks leave to add on to the next voyage, but you'd already been paid for it, if you can understand. So you accumulated quite a lot of, a bit of leave, where you'd been paid for it years before. It was quite a time after the war, keeping crews on ships. Anyway, it's nice to be home, and I went out quite a bit with Nina at that time, that leave, and I'd grown quite fond of her. She was writing to me, so I got to know quite a bit through her writing. After 4 weeks, I got a message to phone the company, and I phoned them up, and they wanted to ask me if I'd go to Falmouth to take over a ship. It was an American ship. And what it was, During the war, in America, they built quite a lot of ships, what they call 30-day wonders. They were built in sections in different parts of America, and then they were brought to some dockyards at the seaside and all assembled in a short time. They were all welded ships. They weren't riveted. And they built quite a lot of tankers, that description. And they were called T2 tankers. What that meant, I couldn't tell you. But this one, it was called, the American name, it was the Tuolumne Meadows. I just forget how the Tuolumne was spelt. Meadows, Tuolumne Meadows. And the American crew were still on board. So Shell bought, I think it was about a dozen of these ships to make up for some of the tankers that they had lost torpedoed during the war. That was the reason. And these ships, the British ship owners weren't too keen on these welded ships, so they brought them into dry dock, and they had a band riveted right round the hull to hold the thing together, because quite a number of these welded ships during the war, that were built during the war, broke their backs, just broke in two and sank. So this band that was put round the hull was supposed to strengthen it and hold it together. And so it was, I set off with trepidation to go down to Falmouth. I arrived there, and it was about a week, maybe longer, I think. Just can't recollect now. I know it was quite a while before this ship turned up. So I was put in the hotel, the ship hotel, a little tiny pub that took a few visitors, the ship hotel in Falmouth. I stayed there until it was like a little holiday, waiting every day for word of this ship coming in.